We want to welcome retired Commissioner Jim Spies from Watertown, and would you like to make any speeches or anything? No? Okay. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Kevin will introduce our first speaker today.
Hey, good morning, folks. Kevin Roble here, Deputy Secretary with the Game Fish and Parks. It's really my honor to introduce Dr. Jonathan Jenks here this morning, a distinguished professor at SDSU. He's been involved with the department for many, many, many years, and really excited to hear him talk about this research results on neonicotinoid insecticides. And yeah, it's great to have him here, and if we could just give Dr. Jenks a round of applause to start things off this morning and get the day started. So thank you.
So ago, working on deer, captive deer, and evaluating the impact of neonicotinoid insecticide. So first of all, I'll just give you a little introduction on this, and maybe many of you know about these insecticides. They've been in the news quite a bit. They were created in the 1980s, and they're very commonly used insecticide throughout the world. Theoretically, they have low toxicity to vertebrates, and they're focused on insects, and that's why they're supposedly really good, because there's very little non-target issues. Although recently, if you look in the news and the literature, there have been recent studies not only with what we've done with deer, but also with birds and other species that indicate there potentially are some issues with these chemicals and wildlife. And they have a high flexibility of use. How they work is if you look at the, let me see if I can work this here. Look at the red dots here. This is the insecticide. In this case, what we used or evaluated was imidacloprid, which is only one of a number of different insecticides that are used in agriculture and so forth. But the molecules of the insecticide bind to the receptors here and keep the receptors open so that you have constant neuromuscular stimulation, and that's how they kind of work. You'd expect that then that the insecticide would cause the animal to kind of burn out as far as energy goes, so that they would burn out and eventually die or so, for the insects anyway, they're the target species. They're used in seed dressings. In fact, for corn and soybeans, I believe greater than 90% of seeds are treated with neonicotinoids in South Dakota and throughout this region. And they're treated with, the seeds are treated, they're absorbed by the roots and leaves, they're water soluble, and because of that, they control all sorts of different pests. The types, there's a number of different types here, but this N-nitroguanidines are probably the top group of these neonicotinoids that are used. With imidacloprid, you can see is actually one of the top insecticides, along with clothianidin, is probably the second most common that are used. And our study actually evaluated the imidacloprid because I'll get into that in a second here, just because of some recent literature that actually has been was published on the potential for that insecticide to affect large mammals. But anyway, this just shows you the different crops that it's used on, with corn and soybeans and wheat being the pretty much the top three here as late as 2014. And then if you look at the use of these, of the imidacloprid here, starting in about 1994, you see that the use was pretty limited to certain regions of the country. But if you move through time, and these are EPA maps off of the EPA website, if you just move through time to see how or just to look at the increase in use through time here, from up to 1996, 97, 2004, 2010, and this is a preliminary estimate for 2014. It's not only South Dakota, but throughout a lot of the nation just this chemical, imidacloprid, is used, and there, as I mentioned, there's a number of others that are used as well. The potential threats, there's systemic, so they're throughout the plant, so any consumption of the plant then could potentially transfer the chemical to wildlife. Only up to 20% of the chemical is absorbed by the plant, so that means up to about 80% or so of the chemical is actually leached into waterways, surface runoff and tiling, and or becomes persistent in the soil. And one of the big issues here is that if you look at the half-life of the chemical, it's up to about 1,250 days. So that would mean up to 3 years. Half of that material could still be in the environment up to 3 years after it's initially used. Now, this main paper becomes important because what they did is in Canada, they looked at the concentrations of these chemicals in wetland waters in Canada. Threats to wildlife, it's just you would expect there'd be a threat to bumblebees, but the kicker is that it doesn't take very much of it to kill a bee. Only about 4 to 5 nanograms will kill a bee, so it doesn't really take very much. So that's the LD50, where 50% of the insects die. But they've also been evaluated in partridges here, where 20% of the application rate reduced clutch size, delayed egg laying, and accumulated in the liver. And then in rats, morphological changes in the testes of rats and altered hormonal balance and DNA in rats. But that's pretty much, at the time when we did this research, that's about all that had been done. And as far as looking at vertebrates and trying to evaluate the effects on mammals and birds. When we started this, there had been a couple of papers that were published out of Montana that indicated that there were potentially problems with antler characteristics, testes, a penis sheath in males, and also underbite. And that's what's shown in the pictures here. Underbite here, this came from one of these Hoy papers here, where they indicated there had been an increase since the 1990s up to about 2011 or so, which was published in the paper here, and suggesting that, circumstantially suggesting that these chemicals, neonics, could be the cause of the problems that they were documenting in Montana at the time. And this paper here, this picture from North Dakota, you can see this guy here. That actually was documented in North Dakota along the Montana border last summer. So suggesting that if there is something to this, that it's not only occurring in Montana, it would be occurring in other states as well. So our objectives were to identify this imidacloprid levels. We chose the liver, spleen, genital, and brain tissue because based on the literature and based on the expectation for hormonal imbalance and neurological issues in species and reproductive issues and the immune system, negative effects on the immune system, we chose these tissues to go ahead and evaluate. So we wanted to identify levels. We wanted to determine levels in liver, spleen, brain, spleen, and genital in fawns that survived versus those that died, because this was done in a captive, in our captive herd at SDSU. Compare behavior of adults and fawns exposed to the chemical, and compare results to captive deer from captive deer and free-ranging deer in North Dakota. Because at the time I was working with North Dakota on a deer project, and their veterinarian had been collecting liver and spleen samples from roadkills and morts from throughout the state. So they had a number of tissues available for evaluating the concentration of the imidacloprid using the same methods that we used with the captive study, so they'd be directly comparable. And also, they had the money that they decided they wanted to pay for it. So I was really happy with that. Okay, so at SDSU, we conducted the research for the captive study at the captive research unit at SDSU, about a mile north of the main campus. We used 20 adult does. We were interested in the does and fawns. We used the does across 2 years. What we did is we assumed that that if there was going to be exposure to does, it would primarily occur during the summertime when the chemicals are being used in the environment. So what we did is we started in about May, and I believe, and then I exposed the adults through October, through freeze. And then we stopped at that point. We did not euthanize the does the first year. We just re-exposed them the second year of the study, and then at the end of the study, then we euthanized the does, and we had euthanized all the fawns in the first year and the second year of the study so that we could go ahead and look at these the concentration of the chemical in tissues. Okay, so we administered the imidacloprid through a water source because we, based on how we could do this, we assumed we could go ahead and use the concentrations that were found in wetlands in Canada and then go ahead and use that those values as the baseline values for our study. So we had a treatment or a control with no imidacloprid. We had a low of 1,500 nanograms per liter and a moderate 3,000 nanograms per meter. And then we had this huge high here. And that huge high was just to show an effect in the study to ensure that we had an effect of the chemical in the study. This was just the layout at state. We had four pens here, separate water sources. The deer were held separately per treatment within the pen system. And this just gives you an idea of the number. We had like the low, moderate, control, and high. Note we have a couple of extra does in the high here because we wanted to make sure that we had sufficient animals in that treatment. And below that shows the fawns and the deaths. So we had 5 and 6 fawns over 2 years in the low, moderate, 4 and 10, control, 5 and 10, and then 9 and 14 in the high that were born during the study. And it shows the deaths there, too, during the study. And then these are just the data that we collected here. Behavioral observations. We tried to collect milk samples. We collected blood samples for looking at thyroid hormones. Water consumption, because we wanted to ensure that the animals were consuming the water. And then weather characteristics. Again, we used that. These are just the methods. We went ahead and pulled the samples. We did all of the necropsies over at the diagnostic lab at SDSU with a trained pathologist at the diagnostic lab to ensure that we were consistent in our methods. And then these are just the methods for determining the levels here. We use this ELISA method here. It's a colorimetric method that determines the concentration. You can estimate the concentration of the imidacloprid based on the coloration in the sample. Did I do that? Okay? Okay, I didn't miss anything, did I? No?
Nope. Shoot.
Okay, so these are data for the adults. Then liver concentrations of imidacloprid. We sampled liver because liver had been used in other studies, so we thought, well, we'll use liver to see if that is the primary tissue. And we didn't find a difference in our treatments, but we did find a value, some imidacloprid in our control, and that was disappointing to us. We thought, well, what's going on here? And it turns out that this stuff is probably all over the place. It could be in the feed we were using. It could be, based on the literature, in dust coming from a cornfield that's just north of the facility that could have contaminated our controls. But we didn't find a difference based on our study in liver, brain, or genital tissue in the adults. But we did for the, spleen. It wasn't significant even in spleen, but if you look at the pattern here for spleen from the control up to the high level, you see this increase. And if you, so the pattern did follow what we were trying to accomplish in our study, that even though there was some contamination in the controls, that the increase in the spleen level mimicked what we would expect based on our study design here. So because of this, and we decided, well, maybe we should focus on spleen. It does affect the high levels of imidacloprid in spleen, and it's becoming concentrated in there, it could affect the immune system of the animal. So let's go ahead and follow spleen through and see what happens here. So the next thing we did is we looked at the different tissues, and we looked at imidacloprid in fawns that survived versus those that died over the 2 years here. And this is for liver, and we didn't find a difference, so that kind of supported the spleen issue. Brain, we didn't find a significant difference between those that died and those that survived. Genital, there was no difference, but with spleen, there was a significant difference between the two, with about three times the imidacloprid in spleen of fawns that died versus those that survived in the study. So that, I think what I, oh no, I don't have that here. So that also supported that, well, spleen must be the tissue that we need to look at in order to evaluate the effects of this insecticide on deer. So we also looked at this jawbone bone length, because it had been suggested then in the Montana studies that there was this underbite that was occurring in deer in Montana, and we did find a significant, although not strong, a significant relationship indicating that there potentially was underbite that was occurring due to exposure to the imidacloprid. And also we looked at thyroid hormones, because the assumption would be then that if there's an effect on thyroid hormones, then it would affect growth patterns. It could affect activity levels in adults and fawns. And we did see this pattern here, a significant pattern that indicated that if you have high levels of imidacloprid, it was sort of affecting the potential levels of free thyroxin in deer. So it sort of supported that what we would expect based on our hypotheses and study design. And next, what we did is we looked at behavioral observations. So if thyroxine, free thyroxine, is reduced in fawns and adults, then you would expect that there would be a decrease in metabolic rate in fawns and adults, and that would affect the potential for their activity and behavior. And when we looked at behavioral observations, we found that if you look at lay here for the adults and fawns, they were both significant. So in other words, the fawns and the adults were less active. I should have mentioned that this is for high. What we did is we separated the group based on spleen concentrations of imidacloprid into low, moderate, and high for both adults and fawns. And for the high values, there was more laying around and being less active than for the low levels of imidacloprid in spleen. So that seemed to support the thyroid hormone data as far as them being more less active. So it sort of suggests that, well, if they're less active, they might be more prone to predation by, you know, coyotes or what have you. And then lastly, on our last objective was to compare the captive results to free-ranging deer in North Dakota. And we had liver samples and spleen samples from North Dakota, so we could go ahead and compare. If you look at the mean here for liver North Dakota versus captive here. And if you look at this, it's about three times the imidacloprid in the liver of North Dakota free-ranging deer was about three times the amount as of in captive deer in our study. And also for the spleens, captive deer average level, 0.18, average level for North Dakota deer, about three times the level in deer in North Dakota, indicating that using the same methods for both samples, that so that they were comparable, that not only were our results applicable to our captive population, the way we conducted our study, but also they could be transferred to the wild, indicating that the chemical is potentially affecting deer, wild free-ranging deer, based on the sample from North Dakota. So the implications for free-ranging deer in North Dakota, deer exposure in North Dakota was 52% over this time period when their samples were collected, 2009 to 2017. So in other words, we had over about 300-plus samples of spleens, and about 52% of those had imidacloprid in spleens, and the other 48 were zeros. So there's a lot of variation in here, and some deer are exposed to this chemical, and some aren't. And you know, we went through trying to analyze the data, and we couldn't kind of figure out why that would be occurring. But evidently, some deer can avoid it. Oh, and what might be happening with that is during our captive study, we noticed that in the high treatment for the imidacloprid, deer were avoiding drinking the water with the imidacloprid in it. And so we saw a decreased use of water by that treatment group, and we suspect that they didn't like to drink it because it probably tastes bad for them. Just that the chemicals in the water were affecting their use of it. So if it rained, because these deer were outside in these pens, we documented that they would drink out of the puddles in the pen rather than drink out of the tubs with the imidacloprid in them. So that might be why you're seeing some of this variation in the wild there, due to the fact that they're trying to avoid, if they can avoid drinking water, in this case, if it is from water with the imidacloprid, they're going to try to do that. The imidacloprid in spleen in North Dakota spleens increased by an average of 0.11 nanograms per gram per year from 2009 to 2017. So the pattern was for an increase, and because the chemical is probably used every year, they're being exposed every year, and it seems to be concentrating in spleens. And then 77.5% of North Dakota deer that were exposed to imidacloprid. So it's essentially of the 52% that had imidacloprid in spleens, 77.5% had levels in spleens equal to or above 0.33 nanograms per gram, which was the mean level in spleens of captive fawns that died. So there's a potential in the wild that this chemical and potentially others as well, maybe other depending upon what's being used, could be contributing to mortality in fawns. Although we didn't look at that in the study, it would be nice to go there maybe in the future. But so we're suggesting anyway, based on the data, that it could be potentially affecting survival. And this just shows you the more recent data on imidacloprid here. Beginning in 2015, the provider of the surveyed pesticide data used to derive the county level use discontinued making estimates of for seed treatment application. So it looks like as of 2015, 16 or so, there's been a decline in use of the imidacloprid in this region, but in fact it really hasn't. It's just they changed the way they're documenting use now, so or the EPA is. So with that, I thank Game Fish and Parks for funding the study. Thanks for having me up here to tell you a little bit about it. North Dakota for paying and collecting the spleen and liver samples for the free-ranging deer. SDSU, the Ag Experiment Station, also contributed funding to the project. And then I mentioned that Minnesota now is surveying for spleens to try to evaluate whether deer in Minnesota have been exposed to the neonicotinoid as well. So I found this out the other day. They've contacted 100,000 hunters to see if they could get a sample to go ahead and voluntarily collect spleens so that they could evaluate exposure. And then lastly, I got this picture from Nick Rossman the other day, which I thought, well, that's really kind of interesting, which indicates potentially, this underbite in a deer from Edmonds Ed McPherson or so County. Now, you know, it could be just a deer that got caught in a fence or so, but it just so happens that we are seeing these incidences that seem to support that something's going on. During the work in North Dakota, there was a fawn that was born without ureters. So essentially, the fawn was born, couldn't urinate, and it died within 24 to 48 hours after birth, which would be potential. And we didn't look at neonicotinoids or the potential for the insecticide in that animal, but it would have been nice if we had to see if maybe there was an association between that issues there and survival of that fawn. So with that, thanks a lot for having me up here. This is just a link to the paper. This was published in Scientific Reports in March, and so it's available online. So if you're interested in looking at the paper, you can go ahead and do so. So thanks.
Questions? Comments? Do you have a sense of what regulation there is of all these insecticides, pesticides? I mean, does anybody have to do any studies to see if they're safe before they're used, or is it free for all, or how does that work?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that if you look on the EPA site, you'll see there could be 50 of these different chemicals that are used in agriculture on a regular basis. And what I have read is that there's been very little evaluation of the chemicals and their effects prior to the EPA certifying they're safe to use, because these chemicals have come out so quickly over the last 20 or so, 30 years, that there's been very little work evaluating them. So that's all I know about it. No, as a matter of fact, when the paper came up, Bill Gibbons, the acting director of the Ag Experiment Station, said, boy, we ought to be looking at cattle and seeing what's happening there. But I don't know of any ongoing studies at this time.
Any other questions? Commissioner Locken.
Commissioner Locken here. Just one thought on it. A lot of times you see these seeds that are treated, particularly soybean seeds, you know, it's hard to get the last one into the planter, and there's little spills around the country. Has anybody ever checked whether set up cameras or anything and see if the deer are seeking them out and eating them off the ground, those seeds?
Not that I know of, no. So, but so we don't know how they're getting it. That the question really relates to, well, how is this chemical getting in those animals? Are they eating the leaves? You know, we evaluated water assuming that, well, they have to drink, so if it's in wetlands, they would pick it up that way. But there are other ways they could do it too, like you suggested there. They could be eating the seeds that have, you know, that are available to them that haven't been planted or so that are treated, or it could be that they are eating some leaves or other part of the plant. Maybe they're getting some of the concentration that or getting exposed that way as well. But I don't know of any studies that have actually documented that yet.
Sounds like a job for a game camera.
Commissioner Whitmire.
Commissioner Whitmire. Okay, so I'm involved in ag, so I grow soybeans, and the treatments available do include what you're talking about here on the soybeans seed specifically being applied to the seed. It ends up in the soil, then the plant absorbs it through the root system, and it cuts off an early stage of soybean aphids, for example, preventing applications later in the year. Are there studies, okay, so if you, lesser of two evils, so to say, if you want to look at it that way, if we were not using these as seed treatments, is there any studies been done on what the application percentages are and the damages done when we actually have to do aerial spraying to control aphids in August, for example?
Yeah, and I don't know if there's anything available on that, but I know that there could be other maybe safer chemicals that might become available in the future. I know we did an experiment with, believe it or not, tannins, and which are, you know, when you think of oak leaves, the reason why oak leaves stay in your yard all year is because they're filled with tannins and nothing will eat them. So why not just go ahead and use tannins and spray tannins? So we used soybeans, and we sprayed soybeans with tannins and then looked at deer use of them. We also did a cafeteria trial at SDSU with a captive deer to see if they would consume soybeans that are treated with tannins above a certain percentage. We had a similar treatment set up as we did in this study, and we found that they avoided soybeans that were treated with tannin. But because tannins are also considered sort of an insecticide, you might be able to argue that, well, maybe they'd be useful with aphids or other insects as well, but they haven't been evaluated, you know, on that. So, you know, there could be other chemicals that may be more safe. When I got the tannin project approved, because all projects at SDSU have to be approved by the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, they asked me, well, are these tannins poisonous? And I said, oh, only if you have more than 3 cups in the morning. Well, I was joking, yeah. But but that's what you're drinking in tea and coffee are tannins. So, I mean, that's all we're doing is putting high concentrations of coffee and tea on there to see with a sticker, so that it would stick to the plant then, just like you'd do that with another insecticide, to see, hey, maybe this would work. So maybe what needs to be done is evaluating some less toxic chemicals that could be very useful to ag and at the same time not be potentially hazardous to wildlife.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes, sure.
Commissioner Whitmire again. Looking at habitat and whatnot that we've done in the last couple of months, specifically land use. So in South Dakota, for example, our southeastern counties are much more heavily utilized for corn and soybeans. So up to 30% or over 30%, I believe, Clay County, 30% soybeans in 2018 versus counties in the state that are far less than 1%. I don't know if you have control or even just a natural occurrence of deer in the wild, but that would be interesting, I guess, to me as well, is if those soybean and corn concentrated areas, how those deer in the wild we're doing compared to areas that are much more prairie grass. More. Yeah.
And I did try to evaluate that with the North Dakota sample, but the North Dakota sample was by hunting unit, I think it was. So the assumption would be is that, or hypothesis would be, those eastern counties in North Dakota might expect they're going to be more heavily into ag, and so maybe the exposure to deer would be higher in the eastern counties versus the western counties. So I ran that evaluation with the free-ranging deer in North Dakota, and I did not find an effect. And again, if you look at the sample, you have zeros throughout the entire state. So even in the east, where you would expect just about all the deer to be exposed to the chemical, you have zeros, so some of these animals are not exposed. So that ends up being the big question. How are some of these individuals avoiding interaction or exposure to the chemicals versus others that are? And I think that pretty relates to your question there, that we don't know how they're doing that, but it would be really interesting to know that for sure.
Questions, comments? Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.